I'm a huge advocate for curiosity and questioning. Whether it's challenging social systems that perpetuate oppression and marginalization, implicit biases, or internalized sexism, questions are a solid first step to the practice of noticing. But knowing what questions to ask and how isn't always obvious. Today, I collaborate with Diane Dutchin, a previous guest on the show, to talk about understanding our intention behind the questions we ask, and how to ask questions that really do challenge how and what we think. Diane shares how her curiosity as a child has transformed over time, from questioning gender roles to questioning her intention. She also talks about grace, and how asking questions reminds her of the grace that she can afford others when she considers the grace that she would like to receive. Hi, Diane. Thank you so much for collaborating with me once again on an episode of Everything is Workable.
Excellent. Well, my pleasure. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad you invited me back.
Fantastic. So my opening question now, which has changed, is just to invite guests to share a bit about when they were younger, when they were growing up, and the point at which they moved into being in a role of service.
So when I was younger growing up, I grew up in South America. I was born in Guyana, South America, and that's where I spent the first 20 years of my life. And growing up when I was younger, I interacted more with a lot of boys. I played with a lot of boys because most of my cousins were male. I had one female cousin. And my perception of it was always, okay, it's the guys do this, or the guys are stronger, or the guys, even though I was there with them, doing things together with them, I had that perception that it was always, you look up to the male figure, as it were. And that's how it was perceived. And then I heard it too from my aunts and my mom and female adults. It's like, oh yeah, that's a guy's job, or boys or men are stronger, so you should leave certain things to them. Our place is in the kitchen. But yet I found myself, even though I was, you know, a teenager or younger than a teenager, I was still doing the things that the boys would do. I was still helping my dad work on his bike, paint the house, do boy things, quote and unquote, as it were. And I would hear that from one type of conversation or one type of message, as it were, from my externally, but yet inside I felt like, hey, but I'm doing the things that the boy does. So why is it that there is this division or separation based on your gender? And growing up, in terms of when I got to the place of understanding, well, this is not just a me thing, it's just all in my head, but it's a universal thing. It's how we as a world we're taught, or it move things that are move taught from generation to generation. And if we don't stop as an individual to say, to question it, or to figure out why, or ask, you know, to get an answer, or just going with the flow, then it will continue from generation to generation to generation based on the discrimination or the stereotype or the prejudice. Or saying, you know, you put the male gender at a certain level and the woman is at a different gender. And just jumping forward, I mean, everything that's been happening on the media in the last month or so pertaining to women pay in Hollywood compared to men's pay.
Yeah.
I mean, freaking ridiculous.
Yes.
And it's infuriating. It's above discrimination. I think it's just a huge slap in the face against. It's like, how do we really perceive and look at women? Are we, I don't know how much I could say on this, on your podcast, but yet at the same time, I'm happy and I'm glad at this stage in our life. I mean, we're just starting to churn at that, and where it should have been done a long time ago. And my hope, and I believe, you know, podcasts like this, and that we get the message out, and women rising up together and saying, listen, it's not a fight against, or a stab against, hey, because you're a man, but it's a stab against what's been done to us women, and say, hey, let's come together and be equal, because we are equal, you know. But anyways,
yeah.
Let me digress and get back to my question in terms of when I moved on to realizing that this is just the way my parents or my mom or my dad saw things in terms of male and female, a man's role, a woman's role, and deciding that for myself, okay, there is something wrong here because I am being and doing the things that a guy would do, and it's okay. I didn't get a pushback from my cousins. I didn't get a pushback from my dad when I'm saying, hey, I can help fix your bike and I can do this better than you.
Yeah. So do you think that was just something then that basically through your experience you realized, like, because you could see it so clearly, you then naturally felt this ability to, like, step forward into a role of showing it to other people? I mean, like, actually, yes, you can question these roles that you've been assigned.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I remember asking, why does it have to be this way? I remember asking my mom that question one day. So why is it have to be this way? She said, well, that's the way it's always been. This is how I grew up. This is how it was with my mom and dad. This is how it was with their mom and dad. And then when I shared the example, she said, oh, yeah, I get that. However, it's just the way of the world. And I said, but do you see the unfairness, or do you see how you're making one individual or one person because of their sex or their gender better or stronger or more capable? Gender bias. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes if I think of my parents, how they were, it's so at that point in their lives and at their age, it was, you know what, I don't have time for this. I'm mm-hmm. just going to go with the flow. This is the way it is. And if you want to stir things up or do things differently, then more power to you.
When was the point then when you started to sort of do this in a more professional context where it started to be really central to your life?
Actually, it happened in church.
Interesting.
Yes, very interesting. In Guyana, I attended church. I became a Christian when I was around 16, 17. And, you know, the whole thing that's around Pentecostal and church. And we weren't allowed to, as girls going to the church, we weren't allowed to wear pants like the boys. And we had to cover our hair and everything like that. But I became part of that church and bought into everything. One of the reasons why I did was because I felt when I was in church, I felt a measure of love and acceptance that I didn't feel when I was outside of the church. So they really welcomed me, and I felt I could be myself to some degree, mm-hmm. and I felt embraced, as it were. I'm not sure if it's making sense, but that's how I felt. So as I grew in church, you know, I started to teach Sunday school, and then there was a sister church, as it were, that opened up in my area. And I lived in the suburb outside of the city of Georgetown, Guyana. And they asked me if I would, they gave me the platform to teach from the pulpit. I wasn't ordained. I'm not ordained. But in South America, that's the way they do things. And so it was a small church. We had about, I'd say, anywhere from 20 to 30 people. And that's where I discovered my love for the spoken word and that ability be able to influence people and be able to teach people, and that it's not just black and white. And it's not just, well, this is the way it is, just accept it and shut up and go about your business. And that's where it started to become clear to me as an individual and as a woman that I felt empowered. I felt I had this platform to be able to share, as I taught from the Word of God, on not just, well, God said it this way, but how is it translating in your life? And just because it's coming from, you know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah.
And that was the platform. That's where that all started and grew from there for me.
Oh, wow. How old were you when that happened?
I was, I was between 17 and 20.
Wow. That's an amazing opportunity. Like, at that time, I mean, that's a very formative time of self-discovery, and to have that role given to you.
Mm-hmm.
I like what you said. I mean, very empowering, incredibly empowering experience.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I get the sort of the juxtaposition with the church and that tension there. And I think this is where there's a Buddhist teaching that I really appreciate, that nothing is ever just one way, which is one of those things I come back to. And as many criticisms as anyone could wage against the church, I think it's also very It's very interesting that that was the space in which, even in some ways, you couldn't feel entirely like yourself, but in other ways, you felt safe and loved. And then you were given that opportunity and a platform and a voice. So
definitely, yeah. Oh. And that was, it was, I know our topic is a little bit different, but in terms of me even coming out and sharing who I was and as an individual, that I couldn't dare do it. Mm-hmm. A, where I was living, and B, in that day, it wasn't, not that I'm aging myself or anything, it wasn't something that was spoken. Mm-hmm. And you dare not speak about it because you'll be chastised.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting, right? Again, it's the intersectionality conversation, experiences, so that you could be embraced and given some acknowledgement of authority as a woman within the church, but you couldn't come out safely.
No, no.
So when you were previously on the show, you spoke about the importance of asking what our source of information is, which I think is a really good practice. When we tell ourselves something that we're taking as like the truth with a capital T, and then wondering like, wait, where did that come from? And like, you've already spoken a bit about that, about how when you were a kid, you're like, but why? Because on the one hand, you say boys do this, but on the other hand, I'm doing those things. So could you talk a little bit about that process of asking yourself questions and how that's evolved over time from when you were a kid to where you are now as an adult? Like, or using questions to challenge ideas you might hold and where they come from.
I think it's not just me, but I heard there was a talk show on, I can't remember who was the source of the, where it was coming from, but this conversation was about kids, how kids ask questions all the time when we're kids. We ask, and one of the main questions we usually ask a lot is, but why? Mm-hmm. Diane, go and clean your room. But why? Why? Because I said so. Just go clean your room. You know, or just go do this because I'm the adult and, you know, I'm your mother, I'm your father, I'm this and that. And I've always been a curious child. I always liked to experiment, figure out things. And that was a question I think maybe my middle name should have been Diane Y. Dutchian. I don't know. I love, because for me, if I don't ask questions, I don't get answers. And I think it's the same straight across the board. I don't care how old you are, how young you are, or where you're at in your life. If you're in a good place or you're in a not so good place, asking yourself questions will enable you to find answers. It may not be the answer, but at least it will begin to bring some kind of awareness to you and said, oh, it's like if you're having your day is extremely off and you can't literally pinpoint as to the reason. Why am I in this funk? Like, what's going on? That happened to me as an example this week. I was in such a funk on Tuesday. My morning, I walked into the office and one of my boss came to me and she was just, you know, you need a few minutes to sit down to get yourself together and take a breath. And in my face, like, and it just started. And I think one of the reasons why I felt so rattled and it really got to me, and it took me just about half the day on a number of other things, and it just built up and the momentum, it seemed like it just exploded, is because I'm on a fast of no sugar for 21 days. And I realized things got to me a little bit faster because I was in my day 3 and I was feeling the withdrawal. And afterwards I was able to deal with it. But I think if I didn't stop or in the habit of asking myself question, I would have maybe just gone on, and my entire day and night would have been a funk.
Right. By asking questions, it's also then a reminder to notice and remember what's going on.
Yeah, I find when we ask questions, like, it's there to understand a situation and maybe sometimes to be even, easier on ourselves. And when we ask questions, I find when I ask questions, it snapped me out of where my mind might be going that it shouldn't go. either judging someone, giving myself a mental whooping, or making an assumption of someone and myself that it's really making the situation bigger than it really is. And it kind of brings me back to the reality or that mindful state of, okay, what's going on here? It's like going into, you know, we all had, if we're getting ready for an interview for a job or, you know, potential contract with a client or something, and we have a bunch of questions. And if we don't ask certain questions, we're not going to know if that individual is a fit for us to work with them mm-hmm. or them us. And sometimes we leave and we're like beating ourselves up because it's like, I wish I'd asked, like, what happened? Why didn't you ask this question, Kate? Like, what's going on? And we miss that opportunity. I say this to my clients and I say this to myself and I say this to my wife and I say this to everyone I meet, is that if you don't ask, you wouldn't know. Mm-hmm. And it's either going to be a yes or it's going to be a no, or it's going to be a maybe. But if you never step into that space and ask, you're still going to be in that same space.
Right. Yeah.
And nothing changes.
Yeah. So, like, talking about that changing thing, what I'd really like to talk about is a bit about the things that do feel very solid around us, even though they can't be found if you go and look for them. So, like, sexism, as an example, you know, my big frustration around sexism is how often it gets dismissed because you can't prove it, right? Like, that's the thing that people, you can't prove that that was sexism. You can't prove that the reason you didn't get the pay rise you asked for was because of sexism, even though they just hired a young man in a very similar position who's actually junior to you and they're paying him more.
Mm-hmm.
True story. I don't know. Like, what's your experience around that? When you're like using questions to kind of open up a space when you're dealing with people who are not doing that kind of questioning, who are not going, actually, maybe you do have a point.
So is it more aligns with what you're looking for? Is it if you're in a job position, as in your example, and you're not asking as an individual, this happened and you're fully aware of what's going on, but you're not asking the question?
I think it's more like when you notice that other people aren't questioning. And you're doing the questioning and you just... I can definitely question it, but what about when you don't see it changing, even though you're questioning it enough for yourself in your own place, and you're getting your own awareness coming? And I guess it's like a question about working with the frustration of other people's complacency.
Okay. Yeah. I see where you're going with this. I know. And I think that word frustration, it's, there's got to be a bigger word for that. It's frustration times 100.
Yeah.
Because especially when you're aware of it, but the person, you know, there's an old saying that says you can't see the forest for the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're trying to bring enlightenment or say, hey, did you not notice? I remember when I worked in the financial industry at a large corporation, and the guys on the floor would make certain remarks to girls that they wouldn't make to guys, and the girls would fluff it off, or they would just be oblivious to it, you know. And whenever they try making that same comment to me, I mean, they would be put in their places so fast their head would spin. So then they just stayed away from me. I would be the bitch in the office. Mm-hmm. And then I would have conversation with my friends and says, did you not notice that, let's use the word Jim for just pulling a name out of a hat, how he talks to you or how he looks at you or how he touches your hand, and he doesn't do that to the other guys? And why do you not say anything? And in some cases, there is that intimidation. The individual, because I think sometimes men know who or to behave a certain way because they know they can get away with it.
Yeah. The skirting the edge of what's socially acceptable because they can get away with it.
Exactly. And when I remember in an office one day, I was having a chat with this girl and she was having some issues with a guy. And I said, so what is keeping you back from having this conversation? Because we're always told in a corporation that, you know, you just don't go straight to the supervisor or the manager first. You always have a conversation, try to have a conversation with the individual that you're having an issue with and see if it can be resolved. And then you would, if it doesn't, you have a chat with a manager or, mm-hmm. or the supervisor. And she said it's because she's afraid that she's going to lose her job.
Yeah.
Because this individual, even though he wasn't in a managerial position, he was friends with the manager.
You know, actually, I've had that with a friend as well. I had a friend who started a new job and was just telling me about it. And that same kind of thing of not being in a safe space where she could really question the behavior or felt like it was okay for her to even remark upon it because she thought she'd lose her job.
Mm.
And it was difficult because like part of it is trying to phrase the question so that you're not victim blaming. That is not her fault that someone is being sexually abusive to her in the workplace. And this guy, he did mm-hmm. really inappropriate things. But again, in that very subtle way, right? He would just stand mm-hmm. uncomfortably close to her
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
or corner her in the cafeteria and ask her questions about her sex life. I'm like, wow, none of his business.
is that still going on?
No, she ended up leaving that job.
Okay, excellent.
But it was, I was in the interesting position of like, okay, how do I present questions to her? Because she was so much like, it's hard to describe it. It's like she was so much trying to minimize what was going on.
Downplay it, yeah.
And so I was trying to plant seeds of questions so she could do that questioning herself. And I think like that's the thing about this. If you see the value of questions and you know it, and then you see how other people aren't questioning, it can be this point of frustration because you're like, oh, if you just got more curious about it.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm really asking is like, how do you pass on that curiosity? How do you model it? Or what kind of questions do you use when you're engaged with other people to get them to start doing their own questioning?
Excellent. Okay. Just going, let's use your friend as an example and running with that. I would first ask her, how does that make you feel? How does that make you feel? And write it down. And, you know, I think writing things down is powerful because it's out of your head, onto the paper, and it takes on a life of its own. So how does that make you feel? Well, she told you how it makes her feel.
Mm-hmm.
So a way to approach this with that individual is to pull them aside and say, hey, can I have a few minutes of your time? And then just say, you know what? I want to share with you how this makes me feel. I feel uncomfortable or I feel... So it's not pointing the finger and saying to the other person, you make me feel this way. You know, you do something to me and I want to have a conversation with you and I say, Kate, you make me feel like crap. I don't want to be your friend anymore, blah, 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 blah. All of a sudden, there's a wall up. All of a sudden, you're defensive.
Yeah.
But if I come to you and I said, Kate, can I have a few minutes of your time? We sit down, we have a chat. And I say, you know what? I want to share something with you. You know, when you do this or when you say this, this is how I feel. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be like being in a relationship and you're out with your spouse and you're speaking for them. And they are mad. They're inside. They're like, why is he or she doing that? But if they never say something to you, you're not going to know. And then at the same time, for them to say, hey, this is how I feel when you do this. So A, is for that individual or for you to ask yourself, how is this making me feel? Because if you find yourself in a situation that's not making you feel good, something is going on there. And you need to know. And the only way you're going to know is to ask questions. Mm-hmm. So you need to find, how am I feeling in this situation? I feel extremely uncomfortable. Then how can I let this individual know that I feel uncomfortable when they do this or say this? And it's in how you say it.
I love this actually. It just made me think of another experience I had. I had an encounter with someone I had just met them, and we were having a sort of comfortable conversation that seemed okay. And this is a white woman I was speaking to, and she suddenly started saying some very racist things.
Mm-hmm.
It was very bizarre. It's like the conversation shifted and she was saying so many racist things so fast that I couldn't keep up. And I didn't know how to interject. And I finally did reach a point when she was speaking where my brain finally could engage, when she did the classic thing of trying to invoke her social circle as justifying her racism. So like, well, mm-hmm. I have Native friends. And I was like, I don't think who I know, and this was that owning it, right? I don't think mm-hmm. who I know is a justification or proof in any way of what my values are. And she said, oh, you're saying just because I know Native people doesn't mean that I can't still be racist? And I'm like, pretty much, yes. And then I managed to extract myself from the conversation. But what was interesting is, like, it was a very deeply uncomfortable and painful conversation to have. And all I could think was, I feel really bad for your Native friends, any Indigenous people that you know. And so I bought this woman a book. And it's a book called Blind Spot. It's an excellent book. I highly recommend it. I think everyone should read it. And I very rarely think that everyone should read a book, but this book is very good. And I gifted it to her, but I gifted it to her through someone else because I was so afraid of this woman and so uncomfortable by her presence that I couldn't bring myself to be face to face with her again. And this was a conversation I had with quite a few people afterwards where I said, you know, I kept thinking, what would have happened, more questioning, what would have happened if I had brought her the book and said, I wanted to give you this book because I think it could be very valuable for you to read it. And I want you to know that it's incredibly difficult for me to bring this book to you because I am still feeling a lot of discomfort and fear from our last conversation, which made me incredibly uncomfortable. And what was interesting is almost everyone I talked to about that said, oh yeah, I totally would have done that and presented it that way. Because you're right, like what it does when you ask, like, how do I feel about this? And then how can I express how what someone said, like, affected me in a certain way? Not saying like you did the thing, but saying like, this is what came
the impact.
Up.
Yeah,
this was the impact of how you conducted yourself.
Yes, yes.
People will... Because no one wants to be told that, like, I would hate to hear I made someone really uncomfortable. I would modify that behavior. I would question my behavior in the future, for sure. I would ask myself, wait, if when I said this before it upset someone, should I be saying it again now?
And a lot of times, too, I think the other part to this in terms of recognizing how you feel, in terms of what is it that you're feeling, expressing to that person how you feel and not pointing a finger at them. It's the delivery. It's how you deliver it. You know, because you could deliver it with such grace and beauty that it leaves the person. Because your intent is, or our intent should be, is to let that person walk away thinking about what you said. Not dismissing what you said. The dismissive part will come if you bear down on them and said, your conversation that I had with you totally ruined my day and blah, 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 blah. They're already shut off. But if you walk in there with grace and being able to deliver it in such a way, they will leave that conversation thinking about what was said. They may be able to shake it, but they probably wouldn't be able to shake it forever, because that conversation is going to be replayed at some point, or something is going to keep coming up. The universe has a way of bringing up things like that after you've done it to individuals to get their attention. And it's going to keep happening. You know, like we can relate in our own lives, certain things are going to keep coming up and happening until we address it.
What's your experience around setting that intention when you're going to have that sort of uncomfortable conversation?
Yeah, you see, and Kate, here's the beautiful thing. Before, I would have those conversations, but I would have it in a state of anger. And it always blew up. I never got the results I wanted. I left feeling more frustrated. It took longer for things to get reconciled, and really the person, what I wanted the person to see and deliver and take away, that was shot. So over time, I've learned that if my feelings are anger, hurt, frustration, whatever it is that is really negative and is jarring at me, I give myself 24 to 48 hours and I sit on it. And during that time, I ask myself, the conversation I'm going to have with that individual, what is my intent? What is my why? What is it I'm hoping to achieve? And what is it I'm hoping this person understand? What is the teaching point here that I can leave with this individual? And when I feel ready in my spirit, if it's 48 hours comes around and I'm, then I wait. Seriously, now I do. Because you know why? On those times that I did not wait, and the times when I jumped the gun, as it were, and I did it out of my own emotion, I had to go back and apologize because my delivery was wrong. And I was doing so in that moment of that emotion, of that feeling.
I think it's a difficult conversation to have a lot of the time because people put a lot of value in anger as something that galvanizes. But my experience of anger, and again, coming back to that question, just have to ask, like, does it really galvanize you? And yeah, when I'm angry, I am depleted very quickly. And it usually makes things worse. It always makes things worse. Not usually. It always makes things worse. I don't think I've ever experienced anger and expressing anger and it made things better.
Definitely.
Like I've learned that the difference is noticing, like, anger is communicating where a boundary's been crossed. And so that's informative. And I'm like, oh, a boundary's been crossed. But I like what your approach of, like, okay, so the boundary's been crossed. So I need some time to settle around that because that it was upsetting.
Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, it's not good to have a conversation about the cross boundary right then and there.
No, yeah. I agree. And the other thing is too, I think what we find, this is what I learned about myself, is when we figure out, like, you know, something in us has been infringed upon or we're hurt or angry, it is, I think somehow it always goes back, if we look deep enough, connected to our values or beliefs. Mm-hmm. And our boundaries, in using that word that you just mentioned, it's so important. We're able to say, okay, this person has crossed the line. They may not know they have. So my position is to be able to let them know in a graceful way that they have and bring that to their attention.
I love your use of the word grace and gracefulness. How would you describe your practice of cultivating it? Like, how do you grow grace? How do you know that you're residing in a graceful place or coming?
Oh, I have a package of grace seeds I sell online. No, I'm just joking.
Amazing. I'm trying to sell discipline seeds.
Great. Yeah, let's do a partnership. Grace seed and discipline seed. No, grace, I have learned to cultivate grace in my own life from recognizing and realizing that I'm not always right. Even though I'm strong on my opinion in terms of how I, my belief or value in terms of what I see, my opinion about something, I need to understand that another individual's opinion, that they're as strong in it, and their beliefs and values are as equally important. So that's where I've learned to cultivate grace, to allow people. And the other way, the other thing that I think of is that I make mistakes and I'm still learning and I'm still growing as a human being. And so is the other individual. Mm-hmm. And I need to be gracious and give them that room or that freedom to allow them to express themselves or to explain themselves. If I was hurt by what they said, or I felt they did something intentionally, or whatever it is that impacted me in a negative way, or hurt my soul, or whatever had happened, or caused pain, then I need to give them that space of grace, or be gracious to give them that space.
Yeah, I think what's really beautiful, I can hear this sort of under what you're describing, is the question of how would I want someone to treat me
You said it. Yes. Yes.
Like that really is the practice of it.
It
remembering
is.
This is a human being I'm interacting mm-hmm. with, just like I'm a human being.
It is. You know, and it always reminds me, I love, and it seems a word I shouldn't attach with love, but I do, I shouldn't use the word love, but I appreciate, and I make it a point to go down to the east side of Vancouver
mm-hmm.
for this reason, is to, for me to remind myself of the life I came from and how blessed I am and how we need to extend grace, because it's so easy to judge people and to pass, you know, to say, oh, look at them on the streets because of this or that, or because of, and I used to be that person. I used to be like that. I used to be very judgmental as an individual. And a judgmental person is a very bitter, sad individual. I've learned, you know, going back to this word grace, to be gracious with people and to show grace, because but for the grace of God, or but for the grace of the universe, there go I.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, that's really lovely. I think about it in sort of Buddhist terms, and that's really beautiful, because in Buddhism we have a teaching of the precious human birth, which is basically like that. It's saying that the odds that we had of being born, of existing, the chance that I get to be here, that you get to be here, is in of itself a miracle. Because there are so many causes and conditions, and there were so many possibilities that we would not be. Of all of the living things we could have been, we got to be human beings who are cognizant, who can grow and change and learn these
definitely.
Things.
Definitely. And you know, the other beautiful piece about this, Kate, is that we get to share our journey and our life and pass it on to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And my motto in life, and has always been, the day I hit the church, the day I left the church, the day I continued my journey to where I am today, it's that if I can make a difference in one person's life, I'm doing very good. I'm doing very good. If I can do an act of kindness to one person today, be it as simple as a smile. Sometimes we think, you know, an act of kindness is always has to be the exchange of money. But an act of kindness could, there's so many different ways we can share act of kindness. And yeah, we have this platform to be able to say, I want to pass this on to you, because someone through my life's journey, this is what I learned. I want to pass it on to you. And someone else passed it on to me. So I want to pass it on to you.
So my final question is really more of an invitation for you to share any resources or support or guidance for listeners that are doing this kind of work.
Ah, oh, goodness. One book. I want to mention a book that I have been one of my most favorite books of all time, and that has continued to inspire my life. It's a book entitled Start With Why by Simon. I may pronounce his last name incorrect, S-I-N-E-K, Simon Sink. Mm-hmm. It's a book that is worth picking up to read. It's worth, and I don't get any kind of, payment or anything like this for promoting this guy's book, but it is a powerful piece of material that will help your life. It has helped my life, it has inspired, keeps encouraging my life, and helped me to see things differently and understand and grow as a person. So I encourage your listeners to pick up a book. Something else I would encourage, you know, be it if you're in a practice or if you're looking to find a way to help yourself expand in your life, ask questions. Start asking yourself questions. And I'm serious about not just asking people questions, which is equally important, but it's equally important to ask yourself questions. Ask yourself questions. Am I happy? Why am I not happy? Is my relationship the best it could be? Why not? What can I do to improve it? And by asking questions, you'll find your answer. You discover your answer. You find your answer. And if you don't, you'll be able to find someone who has an answer. It's like, you know, we go onto Google and we type in questions, but how many times do we really sit in silence and sit in that our own space and say, am I living my best life? am I living my best life? And it could be in any area of your life. Am I living my best life spiritually? Am I living my best life emotionally, sexually? And if your answer is no or maybe, if it's maybe, then what can I do to make it better? How can I contribute? Not how can your spouse or how can your partner or how can my boss or how can the world, blaming the world or blaming everyone else except looking in the mirror and looking at yourself. But what can I do to make this area of my life better? And by asking questions, you help yourself be able to see things differently, go in a different direction, take different actions to get different results.
Well, thank you so much. This has been delightful.
You are so very welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Diane Dutchin is a coach specializing in supporting women. Her own podcast, Women Rising Strong, launches this month, February 2018. You can find out more about her work and connect with her through her website, makethemovecoaching.com. To find out more about my work in the world, to get in touch with me, or to become a patron, visit caitlinschatch.com. The link is in the show description. This episode of Everything is Workable was made possible through the patronage of Gretchen Wagner, Julian and Shannon Hatch, Winita Budgen, and Margaret Prescott. Thank you to Tejai Moore of Moore Music for the original theme song.